In hindsight, all great ideas are obvious. The big ideas of today will become market-leading companies in the near future, reimagining every sector of the economy for the better. Climate, healthcare, food, transportation, housing, energy, and more. Welcome to Obvious Ideas, a podcast exploring the transformation of the fundamental building blocks of life and society. I'm Andrew Beebe, Managing Director at Obvious Ventures. This is episode 4 of our 8-part series on climate. We're digging into the biggest opportunities for founders and professionals in any industry to tackle our climate crisis. Today, I'm speaking with Tony Fidel. Tony led the teams that brought us the iPod, iPhone, and the Nest thermostat. He's currently the principal at FutureShape, which invests in foundational technologies to make a future that's greener, healthier, and safer. He's been named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world and has authored over 300 patents during his 30-plus years working in consumer electronics. His book, Build, An Unorthodox Guide to Making Things Worth Making, just came out this month. In this episode, Tony shares what it means to invest in, quote, stuff that matters, how he works with scientists and engineers to bring that stuff to market, and the potential of design to drive high-impact climate solutions. Welcome, Tony. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Andrew. It's great to be here.
So, Tony, you are often known as the father of the iPod, and that led to the iPhone. You authored some 300 patents over 3 decades. You could have retired and been on a beach somewhere, but instead you became a climate tech investor. Can you tell us a little bit more about the journey, particularly like the last stretch of how you came over to this investment lens?
Well, I wouldn't say climate has been on my mind since I was a kid, but nature has been. Nature really started for me when I was a kid with my grandfather. He would take me out to trim trees and cut the grass and go weeding and plant new plants. And he would then, you know, teach me about different types of trees and how to best prune them and basically doing chores with my grandfather. So that instilled a sense of this kind of wonder, curiosity for nature in general. And then over time, I just really got upset about waste. I started recycling at college. And we got so crazy about it, we were recycling, you know, metal bottle caps and actually taking the little, back then there was like a PVC or vinyl like inside, we take that out. Back in, I think it was 8th grade, I did a science fair project called something like the efficiency of solar power in metropolitan Detroit. It was a state competition, science fair, and I think I got 2nd or something in my age group or whatever. And so I made little houses with showing radiant and passive solar and solar panels. I even wrote a computer program on my Apple II to help you calculate how much power could be generated. And remember, back then, solar panels might have been 3% efficient. And that may be even generous. You know, I've always been in this, so to speak.
And even the iPod was very much a dematerialization play, right? Like you were transferring, digitizing things that were beautiful in vinyl and records and whatever, but they were certainly inefficient in terms of delivery and then recall and being able to store. And that changed everything in that realm.
That's an elegant way of saying it. I think the way I said it was, geez, I was lugging around all these CDs to different DJ gigs, you know, 1,000 CDs. And you're like, those are heavy. So it was, you know, kind of started from maybe that point of view.
And after Nest, I mean, which was clearly, I think, is looked back at all the time as one of the great examples of cleantech 1.0, real success story, you know, Tesla, Nest, Sunrun, these are the greatest hits from back then. Why did you decide to keep going in that department and push into the venture side?
Well, in 2006, 7, 8, I really believed climate change is happening. Obviously, I really do, but I believed in it. I didn't know a lot, but I knew that we needed to do something about it. And the data was irrefutable, you know, Al Gore's movie, The Inconvenient Truth, all that stuff. And the other thing that happened in 2006 was that we had our first child, right? And so when you start seeing the climate crisis, you know, really waking up and you have your first kid, and this love of nature and hate of waste or inefficiency, those all came together and said, now is really the time. And Nest was a green tech or climate tech 1.0 kind of company. And when I would pitch people, they're like, I'm not in that, right? And I had to really think about the other way, which is, hey, look at this really cool iPhone connected home appliance. And then that's all of a sudden where it was starting to resonate, you know, or making your home more convenient. The climate initiatives behind Nest were very much probably third order in terms of how we message it, not for how we thought about it.
It's so interesting how many people talk about the birth of their children as a watershed event in terms of connecting just the visceral personal nature of climate change because it makes you look so far into the future.
Yeah, it's to me, it's really interesting. It's just like, if you have kids, if you care about society, you care about planet, you need to be working on those things and helping to make it better, right? Of course, our ancestors, even some of us, created this climate issue that we have, right? It didn't just show up from the earth. We created this. And we need to really think about what we're leaving the planet with for the kids. And we're already just about out of time, right? For me, it's a moral imperative, and it's our responsibility as parents and as, you know, adults on this planet to fix things for future generations and improve just like we always wanted to. That's not just your own individual wealth or, you know, comfort level or whatever. It's about the society that those kids will live in, right? And the planet they live on.
I love that. You have made a career, I think, as you've often said, building and designing stuff that matters. Now you're doing that with venture capital. What does it mean, stuff that matters? What are the things that pop in that sort of lens?
First and foremost, we can go to renewable energy and we can go to storage and we can go to these different things. And those are great. Those are new things. But what also really interests me and which is really driving me in a lot of ways is the waste or the inefficiency we have. If we take 100% of all the energy we generate in the world by any source, 60% of that is thrown away before it even gets used. Can you imagine if you were only, you know, most portfolios, most companies, if they were throwing away all of that, they would go after it, right? They're like, this is nuts. But that's what we've been doing because we set up a system to keep promoting that. So if we're throwing away 60% of all we produce, let alone the CO2 and everything else, come on, how many fewer power plants do we need? How many fewer renewable energy sources do you need? Storage, all of those things. So I will have to attack those things that usually don't seem very sexy. Electric cars can be sexy, right? We know that. They can go faster, da, da, da. But let's talk about the transmission lines and the distribution networks. Let's talk about where all the lost heat is in industrial processes. It doesn't sound glamorous, but all of these things are incredibly important for the planet. And if we reduce that inefficiency, that waste, man, we could go a lot longer basically living the life we have been living. I hate to say it. But we still have to change that too. But wow, why are we wasting so much?
I find it so interesting that you go after these so boring or invisible or infrastructure kind of layers, and yet you do it with a systems mindset or design mindset. How do you square that, like transmission lines and design?
It's a great question and it's a great challenge. And the way we look at it is, you know, when we invest our money, we're investing in deep tech, basically. Deep tech, climate, what have you. And what goes on is really you're talking to engineers, scientists, these different type of people who want to make change, and they might have great ideas or they have the nub of a great idea or even maybe even prototyping or even maybe some revenue. But to really grow that and to get people interested and rally around a cause, you have to tell a great story. Right? It's all about storytelling. So what is it, the pain that you're fixing? What pain are you making go away? And so what we try to do is work with those entrepreneurs to try to figure out what that core message is. We can see the transformative pieces of that technology, that disruption they're creating. But how do you make a disruptive messaging so that not just investors see it or not just first line customers see it, but how does the end customer see it and then demand change from the layers in between? And so telling great stories, where you tell them, how you tell them, and how you're fixing their pain, right? Whether that's individually or collectively, those are the things that are most important. And this was what we did at Nest was we made an unloved object loved again, which was a thermostat. When we said, did you know that this device can control 50% of your energy bill for the year? They're like, what? 50% in this thing that I don't cherish. Like, I cherish a car that I spend a lot of money, or my house and I update it and what have you. But 50% of all my energy is, you know, that could be $2,000 in every home. What? So again, we have to bring love to these unloved areas, neglected areas. And when we put love in and show the mission and the pain we're trying to solve, then that materializes. It becomes a movement, right? Beyond just maybe the customers and the investors and that company.
I can't tell you, I was at MIT and talking to a professor there, and I asked him, how many freshmen are focused on climate tech? And he had a big smile and he said, 50% of them at MIT are focused on careers in climate tech. That's what they want to do.
50%? Really?
50%. I said, well, what are the other 50%? He said, they want to do robotics and they want to do AI or computer science. And then he said, but they want to do those for climate tech. Yet Ming Chang at MIT was telling me this. But there are others who are later in their career, might be a product manager at Facebook or somebody working at Apple, and they haven't quite found a way within those companies to really follow their passion. I think of you as one of the sort of iconic entrepreneurs who made the transition early and maybe made a transition back to your youth and the way you were thinking growing up, but made a transition from tech to climate tech, or whatever we called it back then. What's your advice on how those people can break out or bridge over like you did from tech to climate tech?
Well, first, that question that you asked and the answer you got is very hopeful, right? I think you know and I know, when we're in this business every day and we see what these entrepreneurs are creating, it gives us a real hope. That gives me real optimism. Now, cautious optimism, because we have to be smart about it, but we absolutely need all these people, and it's great that they're coming. Now, if you're more in your middle of your career, or you're out of school, and you're already down some path, the thing to realize is what we were just talking about, which telling stories, making sure that the product messaging's right, making sure that the product meets the needs of not just the first customer, but the end customer, and circularity to make sure that we're not hurting the planet. Anybody who comes out of tech to go into climate, well, it's climate tech for a reason. We're using all the same principles, just slightly applied differently. We still have tons of bits. We still have user interfaces. We still have things that are in browser windows and mobile apps. All of that stuff is still there. We just have to attach more atoms to it, right? It's just having the will. And if you bring expertise like product marketing, sales, customer success, even finance, but there's still software engineering, a ton of software. We always say that in semiconductor hardware business, you probably have 4 or 5 times more software engineers for every 1 hardware engineer. Well, that's still true in the climate tech world.
So, Tony, I love it. I mean, these are great pearls. And one of the things I'm really excited about with your new book is that this is a book from somebody who's done it that is both strategic and tactical. Your book, Build, is really telling people how to take these steps. So maybe you could just tell us a little bit about the book and ways that people might be able to use it to figure out their path, either as a founder or somebody who's trying to find a way to jump over into this great new field.
Well, Build has been a labor of love for the last 2 years. And it's really been in my mind for about 10, 15, to tell you the truth. And what Build is an encyclopedia of mentorship. So one day I woke up and I go, wait a second. The only reason why I'm here in this position today is because there's been a lot of people who helped me to get here. And that wasn't just because they were investors in my company or wherever. They just genuinely wanted to help. And then I thought about, well, who are all the people who helped me? And I was like, a lot of them have died. And that means, guess what? Now it's my turn to hopefully be able to mentor people and have a message that makes sense and can help. And so I just took all of the different questions that get asked. What should I do about my career? What should I do about education? What should I do about starting companies? How should I manage companies? And taking all of the things that and lessons learned over the last 30 years, this is all personal stories that I've worked on or people who I've invested in, I've seen. And so the book is to either help you find your career or build it further, or help you figure out if you have a great idea that you should go start, when to start it, what does a great board look like, what does it mean to be a great CEO, or how do you even become a manager or you know, product management too. The whole goal was to save any person time. This is kind of the summary of everything I learned. So it's well distilled. And if you want any one of those topics, there's lots of other books you can go dive into. But it's really trying to give you a good overview so you can kind of find your bearings when you're trying to do something hard or you're at that fork in the road, whether that's personally, professionally, or whatever. I hope it does help and inspire people to build or help people who are building.
It feels to me like up there with Eric Ries's Lean Startup in terms of these are the sort of stories of real people doing real things who also get very practical and detailed about lawyers and boards and how to think about partnership and picking your co-founders, all of those things that you just can't get from an article here and there. You have to get from people who have actually been in it and done it and also had real success. And not everybody shares in the way that you have once they get that. So thank you very much for putting that out there.
Yeah, well, thanks for mentioning it. And you know, at the end of the day, the book is really about human nature and failing and learning fast. So it's tons of failure. We're talking about lots of failure stories, not just the positive stories. So you can try to avoid those pitfalls as you go. You have those antenna, right? So really failure is interwoven. But the other one is, this is human nature. So it's all about human nature at the end of the day. It's about building yourself, building teams, building products and companies, building a customer base, as opposed to point A to point B, and here's the algorithm to do so. No, it's not that prescriptive, if you know what I mean.
I do. I love our regular check-ins because I feel like you're always looking around the corner in some of the areas that we both have a lot of mutual concern and excitement about. Can you just share maybe a couple of things that you're really fired up about these days that maybe other people you're zigging while they're zagging or you're looking around the corner on and chasing?
We have one company that announced in March, early March, an incredible funding round. Menlo Micro is switches. So think about energy distribution all around the world, energy distribution on the grid, inside of a product, inside your home, what have you. There are switches everywhere. So the country of India consumes 8% of all electricity for their ceiling fans. This is just ceiling fans in homes. If we added this switch to control it into their control box for those fans, we can save up to 50% of that energy. So literally 3-4% of the electrical consumption of India can go down with one part. So this is the kind of thing, it may not sound sexy, but it's so fundamental that you're like, holy shit. So to me, I get so excited about something like you mean I can save 4% of India? How much can we save if we modify the product and put it all around the world for all kinds of other inefficiencies? And then you go, yes. Again, what we were saying, getting hopeful and getting jazzed and getting excited. But how do you get everyone else excited about it?
Yeah, that's like the embedded design thinking or systems thinking that you can apply and realize you're going to make a massive difference with a small change.
So it's stuff along those lines.
I think last year you said that the world's first trillionaire would be somebody fighting climate change. Where did that come from? Why do you think that? You're looking smarter by the day as Elon inches closer to that line. But what other things do you think might drive that kind of an outcome?
Well, think about it this way. When you have a loved one who's sick, you do whatever it takes to help them. You will dive into your savings. You will get into debt, mortgage your house, just to make sure they get the care they need. You're not going to take discount. You're not going to get discounts. You're going to, you know, you're going to pay over and above insurance if you have the means, or you'll find the means, or you'll ask people, like we see on GoFundMe. Well, the planet is going to be like that. Okay. It's a sick patient and it's getting sicker. And we collectively, government, societies, we're going to have to pay whatever it takes. We're going to be paying in every way, shape, and form through every product, every piece of travel that we do, every manufacturing facility, everything. We are going to be paying that price, and we're going to have to pay that price because we are sick and we're going to have to heal ourselves. And so that money's going to flow somewhere. We're all going to be sick at the same time.
Well, I love the metaphor, and it certainly ties into where we started of you growing up and caring for the planet with your grandfather. And now I agree with you. We are all going to be caring for that sick patient and hopefully finding a path to healing. Tony, we end every show with a simple question, and I'm sure you've got an interesting answer to it. So in hindsight, all great ideas are obvious. Come 2030, what are we going to look back on as an obvious idea that today seems totally crazy?
Well, there's technically crazy and there's emotionally crazy. And I'm telling you, everywhere I look, and I've been talking about this for over 10 years, is we need nuclear. We need nuclear, period. We're all sitting here getting wrapped around our axle about, you know, oh, nuclear waste, nuclear, you know, radiation, these kinds of things. Well, lots of things radiate today. We don't understand how much radiation a coal plant puts off, or even a gas plant. These things put off radiation today. Even the bananas we eat have radiation, but nobody understands that. We're going to say this is going to be the only way we really fight it, because there's only so much renewable, so much energy storage we can have. It's a real easy drop-in for many ways, especially for the fact that we've already making the EV change and basically electrons of everything. Instead of burning, we're going to consuming electrons. We're going to need to get those electrons from somewhere. And the best baseload we're going to have on this planet anytime soon that we can really solve things fast, it's going to be nuclear.
Tony Fadell, thank you so much for what I knew would be an engaging discussion. We really appreciate you coming on the show.
Andrew, always wonderful to work with you. Always great to talk to you. And I can't wait to see what else we're going to do together around the climate in the coming decade, because I'm really looking forward to it.
That was Tony Fadell, the climate tech investor who previously led the teams that brought us the iPod, the iPhone, and the Nest thermostat. Next week on the show, we speak with Molly Wood, an investor at Launch and co-host of This Week in Startups.
I think it's very easy to fall into the trap of thinking that individuals can't deal with a collective problem, because what are collectives made up of? That's just an absurdly self-defeating perspective.
Obvious Ideas is produced by Obvious Ventures in partnership with Pod People. Obvious invests in purpose-driven founders reimagining trillion-dollar industries. To learn more about us and where we invest, head to obvious.com. Special thanks to our production team, Gabe Kleiman, Aniko Steffen, and Emily Brady from Obvious, and the team at Pod People, Rachel King, Amy Machado, Emily Shaw, Madison Lusby, and Jason Mack. I'm Andrew Beebe. Thanks for listening.